Willkommen zur zweiten Folge des Schirn-Podcasts, zur Ausstellung von Kara Walker. Ich bin Gina Samura, euer aktueller Host. Heute werde ich mit HistorikerInnen und KünstlerInnen Edna Bonhomme über koloniale Traumata sprechen. Diese Folge wird auf Englisch sein. Danke, dass ihr eingeschaltet habt. Welcome to the second episode of the Schirn podcast accompanying the exhibition A Black Hole is Everything a Star Longs to Be by Black American artist Kara Walker. I am Gina Samura, your host for the upcoming episodes. Kara Walker is best known for her silhouette cuttings, but also creates sculptures, paintings, and uses diary-like entries to complement her work. Her artworks discuss themes like racism, slavery, gender, and torture. Kara Walker takes a look into the history of black people in America and connects it to the present. Several critics have argued that Kara Walker's art is reproducing anti-black stereotypes and thereby serves the entertainment of white people. Surely her art depicts the suffering of black individuals and exploitation of black bodies. But this can also be seen as a way to process the cruel realities that we have been facing, and moreover, as a tool to work through our shared colonial trauma. And that is what we will be talking about today. Kara Walker's work displays a lot of violence and communicates unfiltered the horrors of colonization and slavery to her audience. The transatlantic slave trade, as well as unbearable abuse, have left scars on us, black people and our bodies. To discuss this further, I'm here today with historian, writer, and interdisciplinary artist Edna Bonhomme. They also host their own podcast, Decolonization in Action. Make sure to listen to it as well. Hi Edna, thank you for joining the Schirn podcast today. I'm very happy that we have you as a guest and that you will share your knowledge with us. Among other topics, you work on trauma and memory. Can you first explain to us what trauma is, and maybe specifically transgenerational or intergenerational trauma?
So first of all, thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to be part of this podcast. I appreciate having this dialogue. And as a historian and as a writer, I think it's so important to think deeply about these issues, especially as people live through various misfortunes, psychological or otherwise. And talking about trauma in many ways is important for us to be able to address ongoing structural inequalities that exist in the world. And, you know, we need to leaven away from not talking to these issues towards really thinking about how what Audre Lorde refers to as institutional dehumanization and the ways in which it plagues various forms of life. So in a way, trauma is very much the psychological negative impacts that subsequently impact people to experience a very negative feeling, self-doubt, anxiety, trauma. Can also happen with respect to various forms of isms, sexism, classism, and state violence. And when it happens, at least in a kind of historical or intergenerational aspect, it can be experienced by entire communities and identity groups who might share either a certain type of memory. So if we think about indigenous people in the Americas, what is, you know, occupied territory at this point, they experience a psychological and psychic strain born out of settler colonial trauma. And if we think about in the German context and the context of the World War II and the Holocaust, Jewish and Roma people experiencing a trauma from the Holocaust and that genocidal process. So in a way, trauma, especially on a large scale, has impacted negatively the physical and mental health of various people, racial and ethnic groups who've been oppressed, and originates in many ways to the subjugation by a dominant group towards those who've been oppressed through sustained physical and psychological violence, through segregation and displacement, economic deprivation, or even cultural dispossession. So if people have had their language, their monuments, their culture taken away, or even if they themselves have been stolen. If we think about people of African descent who ended up in the Americas because of forced migration and slavery, that's a form of trauma oppression that has been passed down epigenetically from one generation to the next. And so this intergenerational trauma of for that particular event is something that informs present day reality. So in a way, when I think about even my own identity as a person of the African diaspora, Afro-Caribbean, also US born, that complex identity of a very violent diasporic experience also is situated from a large historical trauma that is politically, socially, and economically oriented, that has had long-term and sustained impacts on terms of where I can live, where I can go, how I'm perceived by society, the extent to which people who look like me are perceived intelligent or not, and the extent to which we have are reinforced, or the way that society reinforces devaluation, discrimination, domination, and exclusion. So trauma is very much tied to the everyday, and it has, in my opinion, a materialistic way of being.
Thank you for sharing that very rich insight. So when we talk about what you said, collective trauma, which colonial trauma is one of, and you said it's transmitted in the DNA, but also through our actions, like how does it show in our daily lives, for example, as Black people in Germany?
Mm-hmm. So the German context is a bit distinct from the US context. So I guess I'll talk a little bit about the German context, and insofar that, you know, Germany, I'm constantly learning and unlearning the history here. I would say that growing up in the US, when I was in primary and secondary school, we learned a lot about the Nazi period and how destructive that was to Europe, and specifically the anti-Jewish sentiment, anti-Semitic sentiment that was prevalent before the Nazi regime and even, you know, that exists today. And so I often just thought of Germany in that lens. And one of the things that I've learned more or to explore a bit in the German context living here as a Black person is the extent to which there were other forms of racialized violence carried out by the German Empire towards Black people who live not just in Germany, but even abroad, vis-a-vis the colonial dimension. So if we think about the partitioning of the African continent and how that was very much decided here in Berlin, out the consent or collaboration of African people, that was one of the many ways in which colonial violence was put on steroids. And that also set a tone in terms of how Germany and German colonialists were able to use their power and use their kind of scientific expertise to demarcate and create hierarchies of importance and privilege, and also anti-Blackness that was very much carried out in German Southwest Africa, present Namibia, German West Africa, Cameroon and Togo, and German East Africa, Tanzania, and so forth. And what that is an important thing to note, because Hannah Arendt and Amy Césaire and other scholars have pointed out that the fruit and the foundation of fascism in Europe, and specifically German fascism, was the colonial context and German colonialism in the late 19th century, early 20th century. So you can't talk about what happened to Jewish people in the Nazi era without also talking about the original concentration camps that were carried out in Namibia by Germans, colonialists, and the fact that there were German scientists who were part of the colonial project that were also Nazis. Like, there were parallels between the two, and luckily there's excellent work being done by people who are interrogating the links between those two histories and how they informed each other, insofar that anti-Blackness is very much part of the German kind of project, one could say. How that impacts people today obviously is also complicated, and there's work being done by people like Dr. Natasha Kelly, who's very much been writing about, you know, Afro-German experience, as well as the history of Rasa, the history of Black people. Tina Kemp's work has also looked at Blackness in Germany, as well as Tiffany Florville. So the work is being done is excellent, and I just mentioned a few people, so I don't want to say that those are the only people, but clearly there's plenty. But, you know, turning then to a broader context, specifically, like, in my case, thinking about Black women's trauma, Black people's trauma in the Americas, that is very much enacted distinctly in through enslavement, especially if we think about the bodily experience of forced labor, the bodily experience of captivity, the bodily experience of Black women in the Americas. And I'm not just speaking the United States, I'm also speaking about the Caribbean and South America and Central America, where the forced reproduction of Black people during that period was a form of trauma. It also, the fact that there were people separating families very early on and people's languages were taken away from them, religion, forced conversions to Christianity. A lot of that very much was, you know, tied to trauma, and it was driven by aggressive early capitalism that wanted to use the surplus and free labor of Black people that is very much embodied and has repercussions today in terms of, you know, what the labor market looks like, especially if we think about how Black women and gender nonconforming people make 67 cents for every dollar that a white man makes in the United States. And that trend also impacts, you know, who has post-secondary education, who has low-wage jobs, who's perceived to be a care worker, who is involved in caring for children and aren't able to be given certain resources. And then also, and this is the thing that really needs to be spoken about, who is more likely to have intergenerational wealth or intergenerational debt, that is very much tied to race, colonialism, etc. So in a way, if we were going to look at trauma, it's not just a psychological thing, but this material aspect of wealth, debt, and the need and the necessity for thinking about a reparative and, you know, basically reparations to account for that trauma on a systematic level.
Thank you so much for pointing out so many important aspects. I could jump in and what you said, especially the connection between German colonialism and then the Holocaust. I think that's forgotten a lot of times, at least in a public discourse. But then also looking at the Americas, what like bodily experiences Black people have been made there historically that differ maybe from what Black people in Germany have experienced due to slavery. And then also like this material aspect, which is like really, really important. All of that violence and all these traumatic experiences that you just described are also shown in the works of Carol Walker. Like, she's trying to find a way to communicate this to a broad audience through her works, especially, yeah, like the paper cards and the drawings. That is like an artistic way to process this trauma that is like also still inside her. And then for you, you're not a painter, but you're a writer, you're a historian. Like, how do you process the psychological consequences of our collective traumatization in your creative work? Also academic work, of course.
Yeah, so I think that I have been privileged to be given various opportunities and time and space to reflect on the world as I see it, the world as I'm able to absorb it, and to really take a step back when necessary to digest everything that's happening in this world. And in a way, I'm also privileged in thinking about and being able to commune with the words and wisdom of Black thinkers, Black writers, or even ratchet Black people who are not always acknowledged as philosophers, but also part of the working class. I think it's also important to think about those who may not be famous, who are also contributing to the logics of scholarship and philosophy. And one person who I look to, who's the late writer Toni Morrison, who basically said, "There's no time for despair, no place for self-pity, no need for silence, no room for fear. We speak, we write, we do language. That is how civilizations heal." And in a way, she's right that if we want to be able to understand this world, to think about, yes, the gravity of trauma is so all-encompassing, but we also need to afford ourselves that time to heal, to mobilize, to name the traumas, to chart it, to work towards recovery, healing, and justice. And that is something that I try to excavate a little bit through writing and also through artistic practice, through collaboration. But it's also about engaging with a new way of seeing, looking outside the self, and focusing my attention from being in a marginal position too, because as a dark-skinned Black person, I'm also reminded that there are hierarchies of oppression that impact what my experience might be based off of those who have a proximity to whiteness. So in a way, I'm constantly thinking and rethinking about what emotional healing looks like by creating new languages for articulating my reality, for putting things on their heads in terms of forming counter-narratives, asking questions, looking at history. One aspect of history that has been so informative for me is the Negritude movement, African diasporic movement of the 1930s and 40s, which expressed an artistic aesthetic that aimed to uplift the beauty of Black cultures and point to their profound influence on the world. And so if I think about, for me, and this is what I do appreciate about being from the Americas and the Caribbean, the Negritude movement came from people who were Afro-Caribbean, you know, Ami Césaire, Frantz Fanon as well. And it was doing something that hadn't been done during that period of time within the European context, indicating unapologetically that Black was beautiful, being very unapologetic about the Afro hairstyle, kinky, you know, hair, deliberately embracing phenotypical structures that are tied to Africanness and not seeing it as disparaging, even though white supremacy tried to show otherwise. So in a way, that praxis of, you know, embracing my dark skin, my kinky hair, or embracing people who are often labeled as fat and Black, disabled and Black, gender nonconforming and Black, people who are sex workers and Black. That means a real affirmation of Black beauty and Black brilliance in its fullest sense, and illuminating that celebration as much as possible. So for me, in my artistic practice and writing practice, and historical intervention, that means creating a language and making space and building counter narratives to white supremacy. It means cultivating practices of collaborative solidarity by encouraging self-care, being unapologetically Black and defending Black joy. That means affirming the material and psychic markers of myself, and also thinking about it in terms of what Émile Durkheim, the French sociologist, had referred to as collective effervescence. So a sensation of euphoria that feels the presence of others. And I think that, you know, it's so important to have that joyous affirmation as people heal. It's also important to have it and understand ourselves, or for at least for myself as a Black person, as more than my suffering. And so this is part of the significance of being able to say, you know, Black is beautiful. There's a history to doing that, saying that, and that joy is a weapon and a tool for my liberation.
Wow. I feel like I can connect with a lot of what you said, because I take a lot of my healing also from looking at Black movements and having like a historical perspective on our collective existence. Like, for example, the Black women's movements in Germany, like it has given me so much strength to read texts by Black feminists like Audre Lorde, Maya Yim, and then all the others that you also mentioned, and especially looking at radical decolonial fights that have been fought, for example, like the literature of Frantz Fanon that you also mentioned. Like, I take a lot of healing from that, so I can really connect to that. And I was very touched by when you said that, like, we are more than our sufferings. And I feel like sometimes we forget that, because in also my daily practice and then my political work, I'm focusing a lot on these sufferings, because that's what I'm fighting against when fighting for like our collective liberation. But then making space and finding time to experience joy and have fun time with other Black people, supporting each other, giving each other quality time, and then also self-care. But like also with the self-care term, I'm really critical at the moment, because I feel like it has been, you know, disrupted of its original meaning. Right now it's a lot about taking bubble bath and go shopping, I don't know, but that's not what self-care was meant to be, right? It's a tool for us to find real rest and real joy as well.
I absolutely agree with you that, like, under capitalism, and specifically under a kind of system in which people can create an online profile and celebrity status through modes of, quote unquote, self-care. It can feel like it's something that one has to pay for. It can feel like something that's quite privileged, like going on holiday to Greece and, oh, that's my self-care, which for a lot of working class people, undocumented people, people who are domestic workers, they may not necessarily be able to afford or be engaged in that kind of self-care economy that is often presented in social media. But I think at the core, when I'm using that term, it can be whatever people define it as. So if it means like sleeping,
what does it look like for you?
It can mean taking a nap. It doesn't have to contribute to the finance economy system in any capacity. It could just be as simple as a nap or even just like bartering systems that fall outside of capitalism in terms of like friendship structure. So like the other day, it wasn't even a barter. It's just like, I just did this to help my friend, which was to help her take care of her two children who are under the age of two. And that is a form of care work that she didn't have to pay for, so that she was able to take a bath and like whatever as these kids are running around. So it's about forming community, if anything, in my case, and how I see the
also
world.
Also collective care, right?
Exactly, yeah. So self-care isn't, even if it's a self in it, it is about like thinking actively, proactively, like how do I be a better person to the people in my lives, to the people who also have a shared common idea of, dismantling systems of oppression, and how do we, even if, the system of capitalism still exists, what can we do to just make a little bit more bearable so that people are able to just do the basic things in life? I think that that is also part of what I consider to be self-care.
And then circling back a little to our topic of colonial trauma, like what can we do to not, transmit our traumas to the next generation? I mean, yeah, it's manifested in the body and everything and in the DNA, but are there any things that we could do to break the cycle?
So James Baldwin once famously said, only an artist can tell what it's like for anyone who gets to this planet to survive it. And in a way, that was his attempt to illuminate and contemplate how artists can be able to at least take apart the destruction that is being done and how we can like move beyond and transcend some of that trauma. And I don't think that there's a simple blueprint of how one can undo all the damage that so many of us have inherited. And insofar that there are different steps that different people have to take accordingly, especially if people find themselves being perhaps the victims of trauma and others who are the perpetuators and the descendants who benefited from traumas. Like that we're all being traumatized in different ways, and some of us are benefactors, others are not. Some of us have these more complicated roles that we're really trying to negotiate somehow. So in thinking about like what does it mean to process psychological trauma so that it doesn't get reproduce either within ourselves so that it doesn't get internalized, or even to others who we might know in kinship structures or chosen family, I would say that therapy is a good thing if people have that option. Psychotherapy can go a long ways, and I know and understand that it is a privilege to even have access to that on a global scale, and not because people don't want it, but because it may not be on offer depending on what people are, or if it is on offer, it may not be freely available because there's not a truly universal public health system that provides free healthcare on a global scale.
And then like, even if you have the access to healthcare, then I don't know, you need to find a therapist who is not re-traumatizing you, especially if it's only old white male therapists. And then many therapists are not informed about social structures, like all the isms that we talked about. So can be difficult, but yes.
But even outside of that, like, yes, Germany and Europe, there are less therapist of color who can be able to think about radical psychotherapy, critical psychotherapy, from an anti-colonial feminist queer lens. But beyond that, okay, so what if I decided tomorrow to move to Lagos or to move to Dar es Salaam or to move to Accra? Would I necessarily have access to free government-sponsored therapy or psychotherapy? Not necessarily. And that is a product of how colonialism has very much deprived a lot of post-colonial states on the African continent, in Latin America, etc., of being able to have access, full free access to psychotherapy or other forms of medical care that aren't just about contagious diseases. And then what ends up happening is that people just don't even have that access. At the same time, people also do have other forms of healing that are more connected to the traditions and the ethnic groups that are in existence in those spaces and have a vocabulary to deal with mental and other forms of healing.
Do you have some in mind that you can share with us?
So when I think about, for example, a friend of mine who is Shona, so that is an ethnic group in Zimbabwe, she has rituals of healing that her grandmother taught her that are also tied to mental health relief, and that is part of her tradition. It doesn't ally psychotherapy or say let's eschew psychotherapy, but it is one of the many different forms of intersecting forms of healing that comes with seeking ancestral power, seeking ancestral strength to be able to deal with the physical world as we understand it. So people have those things, and that's just one example from one ethnic group in a very big continent known as Africa, not just a country. And I bring that up just to also point out, yes, obviously I don't want to ignore that people have other forms of healing mechanisms, but I also want to point out that why is it that there isn't more access to free psychotherapy offered to people on the African continent or in the Caribbean, etc.? And that disadvantage is also something to be noted. Obviously, there's also, you know, within the field of psychotherapy, there's also inequalities that existed, people being experimented on, forced admission into asylums. But at the same time, there's a lot of benefits to it. So obviously, it's a complicated thing, but I think ultimately, the world we should be fighting for, in my opinion, should be a world in which people have everywhere free access to healthcare, both physical and mental, of their choosing. And as it currently stands, that's not where we're at. And if from Europe, I would say that we need to be ensuring that Europeans provide that care and provide the money and resources, not just loans through the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund, but systematic infrastructure so people can get full access to care.
Thank you. Let's use this as a closing statement that we can all take home and use as a vision for our future engagements in the society. Thank you, Edna, so much for sharing your knowledge with us. I have learned a lot from you, even in this little time that we had together. And I thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us again here on Telling Black Histories. This was Edna Bonhomme on Trauma and Memory. All episodes of the Schoen podcast can be found on the website of the Schoen Kunsthalle Frankfurt and are also available on all known streaming platforms. I am Jena Zamora. See you next time. Danke, dass ihr heute dabei wart bei der zweiten Folge von Telling Black Histories. Ihr habt Edna Bonhomme gehört zu Trauma and Memory. Ich bin Jena Zamora, euer Host, und wir hören uns beim nächsten Mal.